The area, headlights on for safety as you drive. 37 degrees Kenosha, 36 for Racine, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
We welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to begin today's program by talking about a really exciting project that is underway, a restoration project at Kenosha County's courthouse, and specifically a restoration that is planned and dreamed about for Kenosha County's ceremonial courtroom. A really beautiful space and a tremendously gorgeous, majestic space once upon a time until some refurbishing occurred, which in a sense seriously compromised the original beauty of that space, of that room. And there has been a very energetic effort underway over the last couple of years to have this room, this ceremonial courtroom, restored. And I am really happy to have with me today on the morning show two members of the Blue Ribbon panel that has been assembled to plan this restoration project and to raise the funds necessary to bring it to fruition. First of all, I'm really happy to welcome back to the morning show for the first time in quite a while, Mary Kay Wagner, a retired circuit court judge, retired after 30 years, I think, on the bench. And when did you retire?
2001. So I'm going into my third year.
Of 21. To 2000.
21. Yeah. Oh, 2021. Yes, 21. Skipping a couple of decades there.
That's all. Okay. Very good. So glad to have you with us here. You've been on the morning show before, and again, it's been too long. So happy to have you back. And then also with us today in the studios for the first time, I'm pretty sure. I know. For the first time, I am meeting Frank Martinelli, who is a project manager for Kenosha County. And he has been a very important figure in this effort to bring about this restoration of the ceremonial courtroom. Frank Martinelli, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So glad to have you here. So, Mary Kay Wagner, maybe you could give us a little bit of just kind of the immediate story of what prompted this big effort, of which you are a co-chair with former County Executive John Collins. What do you remember about when this story first kind of came to the forefront in kind of a new and really energetic way?
Well, for many years of my tenure in the courthouse, it was always talked about. It was talked about back when John was County Executive. But It wasn't on the cards to get the money and get the county board on and so forth. And then it was raised in the last 5 or 6 or 7 years about let's look at the ceiling. And Frank really is a real spark about the project. And he did so much work to get us motivated to get moving, including finding this matching grant, which is really the impetus of why we're raising money now, is we have this matching grant and a deadline for it of June 30th, and that's what we're doing right now.
Right, and getting really close.
Yeah, well, we have raised over 500,000, and we need to raise another million or a little less, in order to get this matched.
Right. So you were talking about kind of the conversations that would occur on a fairly regular basis from the sounds of it. First of all, tell us what this room specifically is. I've seen it called the ceremonial courtroom. Tell us where it is in the courthouse, what its function is, and then a little bit about these conversations that were occurring about what it once was and what it could be.
It's on the second floor of the courthouse. It has what was originally, well, in my tenure, Judge Malloy, my first husband, was in that courtroom. And then Bruce Schrader, after John died, Bruce Schrader was in that courtroom. And it's an active courtroom. It's used every day. It's used for lots of different things. And but it's assigned to, you know, specific work. I think now Judge Kirkman is in it. Hmm. And because Judge Schrader retired, so Judge Kirkman's in it. It was beautiful with the drop ceiling in it. However, it was never what it should be, because up above is where the grandeur is.
Right. And so this drop ceiling was installed at some point. Frank will tell us the full story of that. And so now the full beauty and splendor of this space is essentially obscured by this modern-looking drop ceiling.
Yes. And the drop ceiling came about because of a legal battle between Judge Bodie and Richard Lindgren over air conditioning of the courts.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court. But that's how it happened, is that the courthouse was very hot in the summer and they needed air conditioning, and apparently they thought that was a good place to stick it upstairs, up above that courtroom.
Interesting. So, Frank Martinelli, I know you know so much of kind of the specifics of kind of the engineering of this. Tell us more about when exactly this occurred and exactly what was done, and maybe more importantly, how it was done, because that's a big part of this story, of course.
That is a big part of the story. So, Ed and Mary Kay can fill in the legal side of it, but bottom line was they were forced to put air conditioning in the courthouse. It was built, as all these buildings were built, without air conditioning. So it was in the late 60s. They saved money by, instead of putting all the air conditioning ducts up in the attic, they actually ran the air conditioning ducts to fill in a little more about this courtroom. It's really almost three stories tall.
Wow.
And the ceiling is beautiful, ornate plaster work, painting, rosettes. And the skylight, the stained glass skylight, is 20 feet by 40 feet, almost 100 individual panels. And the light that streams into it during the day would have been fantastic, but there is a quote by Lincoln, and these gold leaf letters are a foot tall near the ceiling that runs around the complete courtroom, and the quote is actually from his Lyceum address, one of his first published speeches. He was only 28, and it said, "Let every American, every lover of liberty, every well-wisher to his posterity swear by the blood of the Revolution never to violate in the least particular the laws of the country and never to tolerate their violation by others." Hmm. So you have this beautiful, ornate plaster ceiling, beautiful, huge, enormous skylight, stained glass skylight, and this gold leaf lettering of Lincoln. And there's a book that they published when they built the courthouse that talks about how the city fathers at the time really wanted to build something, and it's actually quoted at the top. It's erected by the citizens of Kenosha County to the cause of just and capable government, and they really wanted to build something that respected all of those attributes. So they built it. They had this court case about the air conditioning, and they decided to do it a little cheaper. And so they put these air conditioning ducts between the ornate ceiling, the skylight, and they put a drop ceiling down about 4 or 5 feet and above the windows, and they ran the air conditioning ducts through it, which destroyed some of the panels of the skylight. They went right through in areas right through the gold leaf quote from Lincoln and destroyed some of the ornate plaster. And that was in the late 60s. So that was what brought us to today. About 7 years ago, it bubbled back up about, hey, there's a beautiful ceiling up there. And I knew nothing about it. I had crawled around in the attic and saw some kind of really odd, it looked like cement and top of some certain area. So anyway, we poked our head above there, got a lift, went up 20 feet in the air, got a lift with a flashlight, and we were just floored. This gorgeous, like gold leaf, you know, glittering with the flashlight as we kind of went around. We, you know, stuck our head through just one of the drop ceiling panels, and we were floored. And then I started doing the research and found out what it truly was. And as a side note, that beautiful skylight, we think it was for fire code once they put the drop ceiling in, but they put like a cement-like mixture over it. So the entire skylight, in some areas they broke through it to put conduit for the air conditioning. So that's what we discovered.
Wow. Not to relive history, but I really am so curious. Mary Wagner, can you explain why this became, in a sense, a legal matter, a judicial matter of putting in air conditioning into this courtroom? I mean, what was the nature of the argument?
Judge Bodie bought a portable window installation, whatever you call it in those days, air conditioner, and he submitted the bill to the Finance Committee of the County Board. And the Finance Committee, Richard Lindgren was... I don't know if he was county clerk then. He may have been. And he said, no, we're not paying it. And he said, we didn't order it. We don't have it in the budget. And you don't have any right to decide you're going to order an air conditioner. So Judge Bodie held him in contempt, ordered him to pay it, placed him in the county jail when Marsh Simonson was the sheriff. And some of your listeners, I hope, remember these marvelous, interesting people. Richard Lindgren was an amazing man. And so he would do Huber. He would go spend his evenings in the jail, and generally I hear play cards with Marsh Simonson until he went to bed, and then he would get up in the morning and go across the street. That was when the jail was right behind us, and go over to work in the county clerk's office, which was in the courthouse at that time too. So that's how it began, and it was appealed, and it went up to who has the authority to control the working environment for the courts, and the Supreme Court said the courts do, that the county board is obligated to provide necessary facilities. However, I think they said both of you are pretty bullheaded. And so end of case, and it kind of established a principle for the state of Wisconsin that the judiciary does have authority to require a proper working environment.
Right.
They didn't specifically say you get air conditioning, but
right. Well, and I suppose it's maybe important to say, even though, I mean, the way this was ultimately implemented was quite unfortunate, but we're talking about something even beyond just pampering people for the sake of their comfort. I mean, in order for people to really function at a high level, including judges and attorneys and for that matter, plaintiffs and so on, I mean, it really has to be an environment conducive to that.
And marble absorbs heat. So in the summers, I mean, when it would get hot, the building would stay hot, because it's like marble and it absorbs.
Wow. So the decision was made that air conditioning needs to go in. And one almost has to wonder if because that matter was so contentious that when finally it's decided it has to go in, you wonder if that's part of why it was done in such haste and done so cheaply.
Well, it probably was expensive, you know, in those days. But nonetheless.
It was. And I was looking at this. You're so horrified to see what they destroyed. And I talked to we had special architects come in that specialize in this kind of restoration work. We had we needed to flush out the cost. We'd reached out to experts all over the country trying to see who had ever taken off cement off of stained glass. Hmm. And they're like, what? And so we had to bring in we need to flush out the cost of this. So we did a micro restoration of just like four of the panels of the skylight, some of the painting of the area, some of the plaster work, so that we could really get good estimates on good costs. And these are people that specialize in this. And talking to one of them, the artist for the painting, and we found the article from the late 60s, and they were raving about doing this, raving about the drop ceiling, raving about, you know, this is the modern technology. And he said that's the way it was. It was a space race, you know. Out with the old, in with the new, and he said, you know what, we were far from the only ones to do this
right
at the time. So
they're being swept up in the, and of course, a lot of people did in some ways comparable things in their homes when they had like gorgeous woodwork that they would just paint over, or beautiful hardwood floors, and they'd lay down shag carpeting and so on. But this is, of course, a damage that's in a sense much trickier and much more expensive to in a sense reverse
and repair. A historic memorial. I mean, the room is just historic.
Absolutely. For those of you just joining us, we are speaking today on the morning show with Mary Kay Wagner. Many of you know her for the work she did for three decades as a circuit court. She is now retired, but plenty busy along with Frank Martinelli, a project manager for Kenosha County. Both of them are on the commission that is seeking to restore the ceremonial courtroom of the Kenosha County Courthouse. And underway is a really ferocious fundraising campaign in order to raise the funds that are necessary to do this restoration work. And we'll be talking in just a moment about the matching grant that is really key to all of this being possible. So, Frank Martinelli, tell us a little bit about the hard work of trying to figure out what can be done, what should be done, and how it should be done. I mean, you've already touched on the matter of bringing in certain experts and so on, but maybe you could take us kind of to the outset of this in terms of when one is even really seriously contemplating doing this, what's kind of the first things you have to explore?
So the first thing we had to explore was to make sure it was possible to run all of the air conditioning ducts up in the attic, because they didn't do it originally. And it's a limited space up there. I know, I've been crawling around up in it. So we got the engineers together, and yes, it was possible to put all the air conditioning and all the ductwork up there. So that was the first step. So once we did that, we looked into, okay, and plus it would modernize all of our air conditioning, more efficient, things like that. And that's part of this project too. It's not just all aesthetic. It's modernizing all of the heating and cooling. It would be more efficient. But so we had to prove it could go up in the attic. So the next thing would be, what would it take to actually restore this courtroom, to take the concrete off of the skylight, if it could be done, the stained glass skylight, to repair the plaster, it had been painted over so many times, what did the original paint look like? Because all of our photographs were black and white from when it was originally opened. It was originally opened in 1925, which we're coming up on the 100th anniversary. So we gathered architects to specialize that, and then in that area, and brought in the specialists many of them from Chicago, and set about, okay, determining what would it take to fix this? What would it take to bring it back? And we documented all of the damage, all of where they blasted through the wall and the gold leaf. And we took four of the panels, sent them to Chicago, where they experimented if they could get the concrete off. And they did find a method to take it off, which under the National Park Service, you need to save everything you could possibly save, which was great news. But then with that method, we knew, okay, there's four panels, there's 100 some panels. So then we knew how much it cost to do that. We could then extrapolate that to 100 panels. So we had a really good estimate for that. For the plaster work, they took a mold of the ones, like the scrolls that weren't damaged, and then reproduced those and then painted them. And then we knew how much for those few, so we could extrapolate that to all of them. So we did roughly about 10% of these elements, and you can actually see it in the courtroom. And on top of it, this project is really from that drop ceiling up to restore it. From the drop ceiling down, there was beautiful painting work on the panels. And again, we only had black and whites. But the experts that we brought in actually took back layer by layer by layer and then got to the paint samples and then took pieces of it, put it under a microscope, determined what the colors were, and then they took a canvas and recreated that on a canvas. We have it hanging in one of the window openings so people can see what those panels would look like. Mm-hmm. So with all of that, we really were able to dial in the costs. Once we got the cost estimates, and really to do that work, we were looking at about $3.8 million. The administration said, you know what, really to do this, we're going to need to get $1 million+ in fundraising. So then that was a new area for me, but working with people in our department, we researched all of the there's some federal grants, some private grants, but really there's not a whole lot of money out there for this kind of aesthetic historic restoration. And we had a person help us out, and we ended up getting like $10,000. Hmm. And my boss turned to me and said, well, Frank, figure it out. And I'm like, okay. So then I went over all of the contributors and the blue whale out there, really the foundation that is the leader, international leader in this area, is the Jeffress Family Foundation. Mm. Mr. Tom Jeffress out of
Janesville.
Thank you. Janesville. He's the last remaining heir to the Parker Penn fortune. Mm, yes. So I reached out to them. I researched their foundation, found all of the elements. They only specialize in the Midwest, found all of the elements, the skylight, the ornamental plaster, the gold leaf, Lincoln quote, all the historical aspects that lined up exactly with their projects they did before. And I'd reached out to them. And they had actually turned us down originally. I reached out to them and said, well, okay, what can we do better in the future? But I really felt if I could talk to somebody, I could really, you know, explain this project, and it matched everything that they did. And after, you know, it was supposed to be a 10-minute conversation, after about an hour, he started saying, okay, when was the electrical updated? I said, it was updated in the 90s. When was the roof done? I said, I just did it 5 years ago. When was this? When was that? They wanted to make sure the building as a whole was in good shape. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know what? He says, send me all your information again.
Wow. I'm just curious. Did they give you a pretty good idea of what went wrong the first time? That is, when they made the decision to turn the proposal down, did they disclose on what grounds they had declined, or maybe not? Maybe that's...
They had so many. This is one of the only foundations that give this kind of money. They gave us $675,000. A lot of these grants are $10,000, $5,000, $25,000, $50,000, maybe $250,000. They are really the largest foundation, and with the dollar amount we had to do, that's why I pursued them and I put so much effort into it. They had so many applications that year. Mm. Ours just kind of didn't make it to the top.
Sure.
But after I talked to them and explained it to them, that's when they really like, okay, wow, we need to look at this. Wow. So Mr. Jeffress himself came to see if we actually did all this work.
Wow.
To did all this architect engineering and this micro restoration. He walked in, he saw it. Normally, you have to wait for them to do all their stuff. Literally, he offered us the money on the spot.
Wow. That's quite an exciting story right then and there. Yeah.
Much to the efforts of Frank. And, you know, the county exec, Samantha Kirkman, the prior county exec, Jim Cruiser, all have been all in on this project.
Right.
And we certainly would like to, you know, have this 100-year celebration with it completed or being worked on.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
It would be wonderful. It'd just be wonderful.
I want to reiterate this. This has been a team effort. Your Honor has said, Jim Cruiser, Samantha Kirkman, everybody on the Blue Ribbon Committee, the judges, the county clerk, the custodians, the building chiefs, the
clerk of courts.
This has been a team effort. I'm here, but this is really, there's a whole team behind me.
Sure. So was it the county that, in a sense, supported, bankrolled, if you will, this initial effort, the kind of micro restoration? I mean, how was that paid for?
Correct. That was through our normal CIP budget and, to hire the architect and do this micro restoration. That was really small scale, but it was necessary to really get good estimates of what it would cost to do this.
We're speaking with Mary Kay Wagner and Frank Martinelli about the effort underway to raise sufficient funds to renovate the ceremonial courtroom in the Kenosha County Courthouse. And by early June, a certain amount of money, a substantial amount of money, needs to be raised. But the Jeffries Family Foundation in Janesville then, in what amounts to a 2-to-1 matching grant, can supply the needed funds, almost $700,000 that would close the gap and make all of this possible. I'm curious, as this has been contemplated, was any serious thought given to kind of various possibilities, various, in a sense, levels of restoration? Or really from the outset, has the choice been made or the determination been made that we need to do this, and we really need to do it this way, not go half and half or, almost. But, I'm just curious if much in the way of serious conversation took place about that.
That's a good question. The National Park, the courthouse on the National Historic Register of Buildings. So it falls under the guidelines of the National Park Service. National Park Service is... they're really specific. They really want to be true to the original construction, what was there originally. And therefore, you have to save as much as you can, like the skylight. Could we take the concrete off of it? So you really can't do it halfway under the guidelines with it under the National Park Service. And kind of doing it halfway is what we got, how we got here originally, right?
Exactly.
So being both of those, it really is. Now, what the project was kind of broken down to was from the drop ceiling up to restore all that is roughly $3.8 million with the Jeffress grant and the matching funds. That'll be more than half of that. And then the county would put in the rest. So the project was kind of broken up into that. Now, from the drop ceiling down, when I talked about the panels and the painting and the panels, things like that, and there was actually the windows were stained glass also originally. That was determined to be, unless we can raise enough money all at one shot, to be a second project later on to kind of bring the cost in line with that $3.8 million.
So at what point was this Blue Ribbon Commission put together, and how did that happen in terms of really galvanizing this kind of to the next level? I assume that happened after this preliminary work was done.
Yes, and during what kind of it was going on.
We did all our homework. We got the Jeffress grant, and the Jeffress grant is what triggered putting this Blue Ribbon Commission together. for the fundraising.
And that was when Jim Cruiser was still county exec. And it's continued with the support of Samantha Kirkman.
Very good. So tell us about where we are in terms of this sort of grand timeline. First of all, exactly when did the Jeffries Family Foundation make their decision, or at least roughly when did that occur?
It would have been 3 years ago this June.
Okay.
But as you know, we had a couple things pop up, the pandemic, the riots. So it's been a challenging environment, and I think Mary can speak to the, you know, the hurdles that have been in our way.
Yeah,
it's been challenging. However, you know, it's renewed, and we've been, you know, as I said, we've raised over $500,000 for it now, and we have, you know, wonderful donors, and we're continuing to work on that. We you know, approach them generally individually, asking them for their support, and many community people have stepped up, and we expect more too, and we're hopeful that more will. And it's been interesting for me because you know, that's an area I have not been active in throughout 30 years.
Fundraising, you mean?
Yes, right. Asking people to help out for a county project. I think it's such a worthy project. And people can look at this project if they go to their computers and they go to KenoshaCounty.org, and then the drop-down sites, click on Ceremonial Courtroom, and it will show you the pictures. It will. I think there's a video. I think there's many things that they can look at to you know, visualize this. Because as you hear about these panels, you think, well, what's a panel? You know, a panel just flew off an airplane.
Right.
Is this – what kind of panels are these? They're huge. I don't know how many feet high, but the wall in between the windows and next to the windows. And currently, you know, we have several of the portraits of the judges over the history of the court. When we do this project, those will get moved to a different courtroom entirely, because it will not be the original.
Right.
So
if you go to, like she said, the KenoshaCounty.org, and actually if you just type in under the search bar ceremonial, it'll pop up. It'll show you the damage that there is today, you know, now that we took part of the drop ceiling down, where the ductwork just goes right through all the ornamental plaster and the Lincoln quote, or the, you know, the skylight. It'll show you the damage, but also we had a summer intern take all of our architectural drawings and make a 3D model that shows how the courtroom was originally and how we're going to restore it back to today, or hopefully soon, and it actually flies through the courtroom, so you can actually see the damage that was done, what it looked like originally, and what we hope to bring it back to.
And all of your listeners, after they view that, they're going to wonder, how can we contribute? And Kenosha Community Foundation has been a key partner with us in this. All contributions of 501(c)(3), you know, because they don't go to Kenosha County. They go to the foundation, to the Ceremonial Courtroom Fund. And so they're deductible and ready to receive required minimum distributions or any of those sorts of financial projects. So we're very grateful to the foundation for all that they have done for us in helping to keep us on track with the fundraising and raising the money.
And that, of course, is you know, because they have such a sterling reputation, that's something a potential donor can really feel good about, that,
right,
you know, in
right.
terms of who is going to be caretaking these funds, making sure they go right to where they
right.
are supposed to go, and so on. So is it because of the Jeffries Foundation and kind of the way they do things that there is this deadline in June, the 3-year period?
Correct.
So that's
correct.
Just how they function. They don't want something to be kind of sitting there forever and ever and ever.
Right.
Correct.
We can't drag it on.
Correct. I think there's some IRS regulations with that, too, because they're donating. But, yes.
Hmm. Well, assuming that all of this goes forward as you hope, what would then happen? What roughly are we talking about in terms of a timeline for this actually to occur? And what, Frank, would be your role in that?
The timeline, when we raise the money, I'll say, raise the money. So right. It would be June. We have a little more architectural work to do to finalize all of the bid documents, things like that. The county board would have to put in less than half of the raised money into the budget for 2025. That would have to pass. And then we could put out bids in right away in January 2025. And it would be roughly a year to do the entire from the ceiling up restoration. And I would be the project manager for the project from the county. Hmm.
Frank has a very personal feeling about this room, and I'd like him to share that with you.
Okay. Well, I love these old buildings. This is the crown jewel for Kenosha County architecturally. But I can remember as a kid my father walking up the steps and stopping and pointing out the inscription at the top about erected by the citizens of Kenosha County to the cause of just and capable government. Mm. And walking up, I felt like I was walking into the Supreme Court. You know, you see that. So and the Register of Deeds, of course, was in the courthouse at the time. We had to go get a birth certificate for me. But little did I know, my parents both moved from Italy, and they took their oath of citizenship in that courtroom, as probably the vast majority of people that moved to Kenosha from outside the country. So,
wow.
And, you know, the marble work in Wisconsin was done by immigrants.
Hmm.
You know, you had to get the marble cutters, the state capitol and all the courthouses across the state. They needed the trained tradesmen to do that. And they were many of them Italian immigrants.
Hmm.
So I think it warms my heart when I think about that building being built by people who today their kids are lawyers or their grandchildren are lawyers and doctors and dentists and all that sort of thing in this community. And they worked so hard to make it a beautiful place for us to dispense justice.
Wow. Beautifully put. So remind our listeners, for those who want to know more about this story, and in particular those who feel moved to want to make some kind of contribution, what is it that people should do if they want to make a contribution to this?
Well, they should go to KenoshaCounty.org, use the search engine and do the courthouse or a ceremonial ceiling, and it'll pop up. But if you want to know more about how to send a contribution, it's to the Kenosha County Foundation, Kenosha Community Foundation, excuse me. And that address is, I'm not sure what their address is at the moment. I think we have it someplace in one of our brochures, but it is probably in that exhibit on the website.
Mm, yeah.
But Kenosha Community Foundation is where the check goes.
Right. So reach out to the Kenosha Community Foundation, and that is the very best thing that people can do, too.
Oh, it would be wonderful.
Yeah. Well, it's been terrific to hear this story. And among other things, it prompts me to appreciate those beautiful spaces that have remained beautiful. I mean, I think of like the Ralph Houghton Auditorium at Reuther, a beautiful space that has been to such a large extent untouched,
right,
and left in its beautiful, pristine, original state, and other spaces, of course, we can say that, and how lovely it would be if this splendid ceremonial courtroom could be truly splendid in its original splendor, if all this comes to pass.
And the public can, you know, the courthouse is open to the public. Come and go to the second floor and go into Judge Kirkman, now Judge Schrader's former courtroom, and look around. I mean, if you're quiet and you behave yourself, You could go when they're doing stuff. You could just look around and see. Otherwise, you could always go to the clerk of courts and say, you know, I'd like to see that room. Mm. And she will be glad to show you it and the panels that have been recreated. And yeah. the ceiling is open so you can see what was hacked up.
Right. So, yeah, this is something that in a sense belongs to all of us.
Yes.
Absolutely. So I'm glad you said that. Mary Kay Wagner and Frank Martinelli, first of all, thank you so much for your hard work on this worthy cause, and thank you for being such eloquent spokespeople on behalf of it. And we wish you and all of your committee members the very best as this effort goes forward. So thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
Thanks for having us.
The time is 8:50, and you are listening to the morning show on WGTD. Part two of today's program is from the Morning Show Archives, an interview which was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2011. Good morning. We are speaking for the next few minutes with one of the editors of Mental Floss, the book, The Greatest Lists in the History of Listery. And Ethan Trex is one of the editors of this really fun paperback from HarperCollins, which represents a full decade of what has been around on this website known as Mental Floss. Ethan Trex, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm just fine. So tell us how somebody gets a gig like this. I mean, dealing in the wonderful world of listery.
Oh, you gotta read a lot and get really good at writing down numbers and then writing paragraphs after them. We are all huge trivia buffs and just love going out and finding the weirdest, most fun, most informative stories we possibly can and bring them to our readers.
And how do you go about doing that? I mean, on kind of a typical search and secure sort of mission, what kinds of places do you go looking for this kind of offbeat information?
There is nothing more amazing than Google's newspaper archives that you can just go through, because you'll be looking for one thing and you'll find some paper from 1973, and you'll think, all right, well, this isn't exactly what I needed, but the adjacent story will be something insane. So you can just sort of thumb through old sources, and then you start finding more and more fascinating stuff. If you read anything long enough, you're going to find a really good story.
So compare this book, Mental Floss, the book, to the actual website, which in a sense has spawned it. Is this sort of a greatest hits collection, a fairly representative sort of sampling, kind of a random sampling? What is the relationship between the website and this really fascinating, fun book?
Well, we have a website, and we actually started as a magazine. We still have our bi-monthly magazine that's sort of our flagship. So after 10 years of doing both the website and the magazine, we had just a huge archive of these great lists, and we kind of wanted to pull the best of them out and get those back out there to people so they could see, you know, if we wrote something that we really loved 7 years ago, people probably haven't seen it since, so we wanted to pull it out of the archives and let people see what our best stuff was.
Can you say a word about this great title, Mental Floss? Do you know anything about who exactly came up with that? Were you part of that decision?
No, I was not. Our magazine was founded at Duke University in 2001. It was founded in a dorm room by two students, and they came up with the name, and it's catchy. People remember it. It's great. But I don't know exactly how they did come up with it.
It is a great name. It, in a sense, is really fitting. It seems like a very nice, easy, entertaining mental workout. I mean, you've done yourself some good when you've done some reading through Mental Floss.
That's what we like to say, that if you read it, you'll pick it up, you'll be entertained. There's a lot of jokes in it. It's fun, and you'll learn a lot, but you won't feel like you're reading something dry and scholarly. You'll be smarter without knowing it.
Very good. So I have a couple of favorites that I'm going to ask you about, if you like, and then I'll give you a chance to highlight a couple of your favorite lists that are part of this. I thought in the first chapter called Cheat Sheets for Impressing a Diplomat, President, or Pope, I actually found myself rather rapidly skimming past the stuff related to politics and found myself instead most interested in five secrets of the Vatican being exposed. I learned some things here that I absolutely had never heard of before.
What was that?
Well, for one thing, that there's a high crime rate at the Vatican. I mean, the highest crime rate in the world. Never knew that till I read Mental Floss.
Right. I mean, that's almost a math thing, because not that many people live there, but lots of people go to the Vatican as tourists or go there to go to mass. So it's pickpocket central, apparently.
Evidently.
Like 1.5 crimes each year per citizen of the Vatican, which is insane.
Hmm. A lot of the lists here are kind of crazy off-the-wall lists, but some of them really contain really good, solid, equally fascinating information. For instance, I really like the last list in the second chapter, lists that should come with a lab coat, which are all lists related to scientific matters of one kind or another. And the final list in that chapter is 5 Ways Museums Detect Forgeries. It's the kind of thing we know somebody knows a lot about, but typically it isn't us who knows very much about how that's done.
Oh, that stuff is fascinating. My favorite thing in that list is that when people are trying to verify that an old painting is real, you can look at these little cracks in the paint, and they don't crack randomly. So they crack in very specific ways, and if it's real, it will be cracked one way, and if it's fake, it will be cracked another. It's just so cool to look at.
Absolutely. Never knew that. I also, as someone who is in the middle of his life, been sort of rebitten by the Crayola crayon bug. I enjoyed reading about some of the retired Crayola crayons over the years and the reason why some of their colors have been retired over the years. Fun stuff.
Yeah, Prussian blue used to be a really popular crayon, but then I guess in the late 50s, after Prussia hadn't been a country for a long time, Crayola realized kids didn't know where Prussia was. So they changed it to Midnight Blue, which is a little less exciting.
Right. And, of course, it's interesting to read about how, understandably, Crayola felt compelled at some point, I think you say in the early 60s, to change the Crayola that had been called Flesh to Peach, because, of course, Crayola knew as well as all of the rest of us knew that flesh comes in all kinds of different colors. Lots of interesting information like that in this book. Why don't you tell us a couple of your favorite lists that we should seek out?
Oh, one of my favorite ones is we have a piece on 5 famous actors and the roles they turned down, because it's just amazing to think about these really famous movies, what they would have been like if they'd gotten their original casting choices. Like in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, they originally wanted Sean Connery to play Gandalf, and New Line Cinema, who was producing the movie, wanted him so badly they offered him 15% of the worldwide gross on the movie if he would take it, and he still turned it down, and obviously Ian McKellen played the part. If he had taken it, he would have gotten $400 million. It would have been the most lucrative role any actor had ever played.
Incredible. That just kind of makes you stop and shake your head, doesn't it? I mean, we just can't reimagine that.
At that point, you can barely even conceive of how much money that is, so I guess he's probably not kicking himself too hard. I mean, he was James Bond. He still has that going for him.
Right. And, of course, you talk about other celebrities, about famous books and what they were almost called, fun little things about children and babies, all kinds of things found in this fascinating book called Mental Floss, The Book. Only the greatest lists in the history of listry. This is a paperback from HarperCollins. And I had great fun reading this, Ethan Trex, and look forward to reading it again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Doug.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Elizabeth Brownson, who is a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And Elizabeth Brownson is soon to be teaching a one-day class through the Adventures in Lifelong Learning program and taking on quite a substantial and complicated topic, namely the current conflict between Israelis and Palestinians and the historical roots of that conflict. And the surprising story of how Israelis and Palestinians once upon a time coexisted much more peacefully than is currently the case. We'll be talking about that tomorrow on The Morning Show. And on Friday, several different interviews, including one with Barney Salzberg, author and illustrator of a wonderful new